Life's Third Act is a podcast dedicated to helping you get the most out of your retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, here's attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Welcome to another episode of Life's Third Act. This week, we're going to look at the life of someone that all of you know, I believe, on this occasion. This isn't always the case, but this occasion, I think everyone will know the name Casey Kasem. Marley has proposed, as she always does. She's the one who does our research. She's the one who has the ideas about this show. I just kind of show up. So anyway, but no, it is a great idea. So tell us, set the context for Casey Kasem, his life, his death. I think all of our audience know he passed away several years ago. But give us an overview of his life.
Yeah, so Casey Kasem, you know, a lot of people know him for a lot of different things. He had the American Top 40. He was a big radio DJ. He was the voice of Shaggy and Scooby-Doo and a bunch of other characters on children's shows. And I really wanted to discuss him today because the end of his life is a little bit crazy between, you know, a bunch of different family members and not having a proper conservatorship set up or a PO, a power of attorney set up. So I just thought it would be really interesting to kind of move away from estates for, it's still, you know, estate.
We'll talk about the implications.
But, yes, yeah. But move away from that for a little bit and come back to this and kind of discuss everything that happened.
Well, and I'm a little surprised that you know much about Casey Kasem. So this was one of my surprises because those of us, you watching, who are, I'm 65, so I'm betting most of our audience is above age 60. It may turn out there's a more your age than above 60, but we all know Casey Kasem. I mean, he was a guy that I don't know how many hours during the 70s, you know, 1970s, that I would have listened to his countdowns. Because you didn't have the access at that time to be able to hear all the songs you wanted to hear. And to be able to hear every song in the order of its popularity and to have the suspense associated with it. Because you couldn't kind of jump ahead as you can now, and you can know kind of the outcome of everything now because of our media world,
yes,
as well as technology. But so now it's very different. It's hard to imagine how big he was. But I'm encouraged by the fact that people your age still know that name.
Yeah. He was, I loved Scooby-Doo, like I had said, so I knew that voice. And then also I love Saved by the Bell, and he did a bunch of cameos in there.
See, I don't know that.
Yeah.
That's a show?
Yeah, it's a show. It's about a couple of like teenagers in high school during the 70s and 80s. And they had him on there, and he was playing himself basically as a DJ. And they did a bunch of cameos where he did the Casey Kasem or I'm Casey Kasem, and that's a big reason of who I knew he was. So,
yeah, he's really he's had a special way of feeling very familiar. You felt like he was your best friend, and whenever he did the countdowns, which we'll talk about how that continued going longer than many of us, longer than I certainly realized, it was so familiar. It's like somebody sitting at your kitchen table and talking to you. And it was a trusted voice. And this, there was something about his voice, about his demeanor. He just sounded very credible. So let's start with a little biographical information, and we'll come as we always do to talk about what lessons are there for us here. And as we often say on the show, we want to entertain you. So whatever subject matter we have, we want it to be interesting. So we try to choose people in circumstances that are interesting, but we also pick them for their educational potential. And we want there to be an opportunity to learn something here as well as be entertained. So let's start with his biographical info. Tell us something about his early life.
Yeah, so he was born in April 1932. He was born to Lebanese immigrants in Detroit, and they were grocers, so he didn't come from a whole lot. You know, he definitely worked his way up. They were first generation. Was forced to speak English. Well, not forced, but they wanted him to speak English, even though their first language was Arabic.
Yeah.
So that's how he learned English, and you know, that's kind
of
how
that was characteristic of the era with immigrants. Yeah. Immigrants wanted, their goal was to assimilate and to become successful in the United States. And at the time that meant, and to some extent perhaps still means, it means blending into the culture, you know, adopting language and other things that are helpful in success and whoever heads corporations or whatever in America. I do think it's much less true today.
Strong roots are essential for a healthy tree, especially your family tree. That's why you work hard to take care of your family every day. At Tucker Allen, we know that taking care of your family means planning for the future. Our team provides personalized estate planning to help you protect your family, your legacy, and your future. From wills and trusts to long-term care and estate planning, count on Tucker Allen, personalized estate planning made simple.
But it's funny, immigrants at that time, less so today, they were, rather than determined to hang on to their identity, they were determined that, you know, we're going to enter this melting pot, we're going to blend into this melting pot, and we do that because we believe it will be ultimately more successful.
Better for us, yeah.
So his dad owned a business?
Yeah, the grocery store. Both of his parents owned the business.
And this was in Michigan?
Yes. Yep.
So he grew up in Michigan.
Grew up in Michigan, and then he went to college in Michigan as well. Wayne State.
I'm familiar with Wayne State University, and I'm wondering, is that because of their basketball team? Anyway, I hope I don't offend Wayne State graduates. Very, very proud Wayne State graduates. In any case, he went there,
yes.
Probably among, I suspect, among their successful graduates, I'll say. While he was in college, he got exposed to radio.
Yeah, so in the 1940s, he was exposed to make-believe ballroom, and that really is what inspired him in his career. And then he started reporting on some of their sports teams in college, and so that was like his first experience in radio, and it kind of just went from there. But it went from there, and then it stopped because he was actually drafted for the Army, and he went to Korea, and he was an announcer for the Army's radio.
In Korea,
yes.
Yeah. What am I? MASH. MASH was based on Korea, too, wasn't it? Yeah, I'm thinking of Adrian Cronow. Is that the name of the guy who was in Vietnam and was played by Robin Williams in a movie called Good Morning, Vietnam? So he may have been Korea's counterpart to that. Anyway, he gets out of the military. Mm-hmm. He now wants to enter radio.
He wants to enter radio, and he does a couple of different things. He was a television host for like a small television station. He did a little bit more in sports, but then he ultimately went back to work with his parents at the grocery store for a little bit.
And what's interesting is his career wasn't like an arrow, you know, in which he knew what he wanted. You know, he had exposure to radio. He knew he liked it early on. He did want a career in radio, but apparently he wasn't so committed that when things were tough for him as they were early on. This isn't a simple success story where somebody has a meteoric rise. He struggled. He went to a number of radio stations. And, of course, he went in the military. He comes back. He tries to work in a few radio stations that isn't generating much money, which, you know, I can tell you about the industry, the radio industry, to the extent it still exists. There are a few people that make a whole lot of money and a ton of them that don't. So if you're in any given city in America, this would be true 10 years ago. Terrestrial radio has changed. But so certainly 10 years ago and probably today is, you know, let's say you have, you know, in DJs that are on in the morning, talk personalities. Maybe you have 15 or 20 in a medium-sized city that are of any prominence. There may be three of those that are making any real money. And in some cases, there's just one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's very difficult to make a lot of money in radio. It's a brutal industry. And I think the reason that's true, and it's true for a lot of industries, where industries that have the characteristic that they attract people because of their fascination with it. You know, it's really fun. It's something they love. We can think of other example, pilots to some extent, although pilots are making more money now. But for a long time, it drew so many young boys and now and more recently girls who, as children, I want to be a pilot. And so unless you're with one of the major airlines, you know, until very recently, you were making $50,000-$40,000 mm-hmm. a year. And there were a lot of people who could fly a plane. So unless you're with a major carrier, you weren't making much. And even with major carriers, they weren't making much until very recently. There was a new, you know, union negotiation. But so radio is kind of like it attracted this cult following of mainly young boys, but girls too, who fell in love with it and were fascinated with it, all things about it, you know, the celebrity that went with it, et cetera. So it was easy to get hire people to work in radio stations. So you had DJs that were very familiar names, but it was fame without money in the sense that they would move from station to station. You know, often they were kind of bohemian types and they had this cool personality. And you would find that over 20 years they'd worked at three or four different stations mm-hmm. in a given city. Sometimes they'll move from city to city. So there's not a clear pathway to fame and fortune in that industry. Now, it probably was a little better at the time in the 50s when he was, you know, trying to make mm-hmm. his way. It had a little more prominence, probably a little mm-hmm. less competition. But still, it was such a close call for him that apparently at one point in his late 20s, he decides, I'm going to go help my parents with the grocery store.
Yeah, and so he did, and he realized that he missed radio a lot, so he kept reapplying, and eventually he got on a show called Cleveland Bandstand.
So he went to Cleveland.
Yes, and he was known as Casey at the Mic on like a late night spot. So that was really brief, but it was really big for him.
Yeah, so the station that he was at in Cleveland became a top two or three station mm-hmm. in a 6-month period. Mm-hmm. It had been trailing like seventh or eighth in the market. So it moved up fast, and they attributed it largely to his show.
Mm-hmm.
And he was putting his toe in what became his signature thing.
Yes.
Where he was starting to introduce music, a little bit about the music mm-hmm. and be playful in the introductions in a way that, believe it or not, nobody was doing at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, he was very, I think people like related to him a lot just because he was, like you said, he was like somebody that you wanted to sit at your table with and just have a conversation with. And I kind of think of him because I've listened to some of the top 40, but he kind of reminds me of just like a podcaster almost of just being relational, like, and you mm-hmm. can just have that conversation, you just feel comfort in sitting with his voice.
Yeah, that's a good point. Now you mentioned, I hadn't thought about it. He probably could have done well in a medium that was audiovisual.
Oh,
well,
yeah.
Think about, you know a little bit about Johnny Carson. Mm-hmm. Many more of you know a lot about Johnny Carson. He had this, you know, that quality that we think of with somebody like, you've seen Johnny Carson.
Yes.
And so it's a special person that can be warm mm-hmm. and that you trust and that, you know, you share their views. You expect their views to be similar to your views mm-hmm. and your opinions, et cetera. So when they're introducing something, then you tend to want to listen. I think your point's well taken. He probably would have succeeded, and he's a nice-looking guy.
Yeah, he's very personable. I think he's just, people find comfort in people like that, especially when it comes to, you know, podcasting, radio, everything. There's a reason you always turn on the same ones every single day.
So he's making his way around with stations in the 60s. Where else? Did he go to Buffalo?
Yes, he went to Buffalo. And then he went to WJW.
And so how did he get on the get into a market where he could really soar?
Yeah, so WJW really helped him out with that. He went from their night spot to their earlier spot, and he just kind of went from there, and then he made that transition to California.
California,
yeah,
that was it.
And that's where he started the American Top 40, and that was really, I mean, he was already pretty big, but when he started the American Top 40, that's where it really hit everything off for him, and he started doing, you know, more vocal acting. He had a couple of cameos in different shows, so he was just kind of all over the place, and I feel like even if you don't know Casey Kasem in radio, you know him just a little bit from somewhere else, or at least the mm-hmm. name.
Yeah, and I think many of our viewers don't realize he did a lot of, you know, mm-hmm. appearances in episodes of television shows, Hawaii 5-0, What else was he on?
He did, I just know the kids' shows, but Scooby-Doo, Sesame Street. And then there was this, I never watched this, but there was like this Transformers animated one that he did a couple of voiceovers in. And
yeah,
then, of course,
that
Saved
was
by
later.
The Bell. Yeah.
Yeah.
He was Robin in Super Friends, which was the DC superhero show.
Oh, yeah.
When was that?
73 to 85.
Okay. So, he really got around. And then he had various TV appearances. He's in a number of movies. Nothing, no prominent role, but cameos and whatnot. When he got to L.A., he became very busy.
Yes.
And this was toward the latter part of the 60s. And he got the deal with doing the role of Shaggy mm-hmm. in 69 or something.
Yeah, that was in 69, and it ran all the way through, I believe, 07 was one of the last movies he did for Scooby-Doo.
That is incredible.
Yeah,
what a
run. Really long run. He did, I mean, just my Scooby-Doo knowledge lore. He did from when they had like the little one Scrappy-Doo and the old episodes all the way through like What's New Scooby-Doo and a couple of their bigger movies that actually appeared in theaters because I remember going to see them as a kid. But that was something huge for him.
You know, that's so interesting to me that when I was a kid, that was probably my favorite cartoon mm-hmm. series was Scooby-Doo. Many of you, I'm sure that's true too. And I'm really encouraged the fact that you were telling me before we even came on camera, when you told me that you loved Scooby-Doo growing up.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking how enduring that is. Now, some of those were newer episodes, but you said you liked the original.
Yeah, I love the original. What they're doing now, I don't like with it. The newer cartoons, it's just they're kind of weird. But I watched all of those on Cartoon Network, and it was definitely the older ones. It was just the original Scooby-Doo, and then they came out with the updated version of What's New Scooby-Doo, and that ran from like 02 to 05, I believe. There wasn't a ton, but those are definitely some of my favorite episodes too. So those were appearing when I was little. So
wow. So let's talk about the franchise that I think has made him most famous. Maybe Scooby-Doo has. So it was what, in 1970 or so?
Yes.
That he does this deal to have a top 40 countdown. Mm-hmm. And at that time, this original run was not Casey Kasem's top 40. Mm-hmm. That was branded later. But the first run, which went through 88.
Yes.
Wow. From, say, 70 or 71 through 88. What a run in countdown. But clearly, you had a top 40.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that became unclear over time. It was, in other words, there were lots of genres of music and those clear lines that existed, this one thing called pop music, mm-hmm. where there was one list that everybody wanted, unless you were country or beyond country. It really wasn't a place. I mean, if you're easy listening music, there's no list for that.
Mm-hmm.
Rock music, there was no list for that. Album rock, for example, there were top albums. But in terms of what was popular at the time and top songs and hits, this was it. I mean, all over. I'm sure it wasn't just America. I'm sure it was Europe and much of the world was listening to this top 40.
Mm-hmm.
Man, his audience must have been huge. So he came up with the concept, he and two other guys. So, and you don't need to know their names, but there are originally three people that started out with the show in 71. And very quickly, the others dropped away. And I think it was just simple popularity, and mm-hmm. it was always going to be Casey's voice primarily. So it was always he was always the one who was associated with the top 40. But, you know, for the next 17, 18 years, people were sitting every week listening to these.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Like you said, I mean, there wasn't Spotify. There wasn't, you know, Pandora, Apple Music, or anything like that back then. I mean, even in the early 2000s, we didn't have anything like that.
Not Sirius Radio.
No, yeah, nothing like that. So I remember listening to, like, whatever they changed it into then, top 40s, top 10, top 5, what have you. But yeah, I think people just loved it because, A, they could listen to their favorite music, and B, he was just a really good radio host. He was just... Mm-hmm. Very, like, yeah, personable, and people liked listening to him.
Yeah, yeah, and it was, you were capable of having more fame, quite frankly, mm-hmm. than in many ways, because it's almost as if they're really one stage. Mm-hmm. And even cool bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, they wanted, now the Beatles, of course, were gone by 70, I guess, but still, all these bands that were otherwise rock, they liked having a hit every now and then on the top 40, mm-hmm. and they knew it gave them exposure. And they all, you know, cherished those achievements. And now it's just much more scattered and diverse. Yes. And there's no single place, as there was at the time, where you would find 80% of your audience, 80% of the world audience, mm-hmm. almost, but certainly the United States audience is going to be listening top 40, even though they don't, they may prefer primarily rock music, they may prefer primarily disco, but they would have some of their hits on that list, and some of the bands they liked would be on that list.
Yes.
So it was a special time and a special opportunity, and Casey Kasem was there for that.
Yeah.
We don't know. We couldn't find how much he made over those years, what his compensation was. If somebody has access to that, that'd be interesting to see. Mm-hmm. We'll post it if you send it to us. But we know he made a lot of money, and we know that it was his brand. And I guess we should talk about the transition that took place when you could say that the original weekly top 40 and it's that quote unquote show franchise ended technically in 88 or 87.
Mm-hmm.
And then immediately thereafter, a new franchise was started that ran until 07 or 08.
Yeah, so
maybe it's 06.
Yeah, there was like some contract dispute with his with one of the companies at one of the networks, and so he left because he didn't want to deal with it anymore. And he went over to a different network and started Casey's Top 40. And I think honestly people liked that probably more than the American Top 40 just because yeah. It was Casey, it was branded as him, and that's what had really drawn people to the Top 40 in the first place. So he signed a big contract with them, and he ran with that for a while. And then he branched off of that with, like, the country Top 40 because, like you said, there wasn't really anything for that, and then a couple of different genres. So honestly, I think we have him to attribute for all of those genres getting top lists because they wouldn't really have it without him.
Yeah, that's a good point. And the fact that he was able to monetize
yeah.
his brand in so many ways. So he was shrewd enough to know that he had name recognition with people who liked country mm-hmm. music. He had name recognition with people who liked other, what would be, I don't think he did rap, did he?
No.
But anyway, yeah. So he had a lot of name recognition, and he was able to pivot and to simultaneously do lists from other genres of music because mm-hmm. things became subdivided that weren't, you know, a decade earlier.
Yeah.
So he did that up until, he was active until I think 09, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was 09. It eventually transitioned back to the it was just Top 40, I believe. I think they dropped the name, but they transitioned back and it kind of meshed together the American and Casey because I think after he left, obviously the American Top 40 probably didn't do so well.
No.
Because all of his followers followed him. So they kind of meshed that back together and it ran through 2009.
You know what's interesting? I'd hate to be the investors that owned America's Top 40 and to not have some sort of contract that was airtight to mm-hmm. forbid, you know, a covenant not going. To compete. But covenants not to compete, as I'm sure they had something like that. I'm not sure, because it may be that Casey's negotiating power was such that they couldn't get it. Sometimes, you know, you want it with a prominent person or a key person, but you can't get it because the person won't agree to it and you really want them. So we don't know what limitations, if any, there were on his capability of going out and competing. Mm-hmm. We know he did go out and form a new entity, so at that point, at least, he could do it. But, you know, that's the danger of having invested as these others had, the other owners in that show, was that it was all about Casey. And when Casey decides to leave, even covenants not to compete, you should know you can't have a 20-year covenant not to compete. They're not enforceable. They're enforceable for generally at most like 5 years. And even then it has to be reasonable. So Covenants Not to Compete have to be reasonable both as to range, geographical area, as well as duration. So, you know, they really couldn't have kept him down for long. Mm-hmm. And furthermore, at some point, he had such negotiating power that they couldn't have, you know, they couldn't have gotten something as restrictive as they wanted. So I'm sure that was a huge blow to the value of that company, to that business. And later they sort of resurrected and merged the mm-hmm. two entities. We don't know the details of that, but so let's now move to what was going on in Casey's personal life.
Yeah. So in 1972, Casey actually married Linda Meyer, and they had the three kids together, and they were Mike, Julie, and Carrie. And that marriage lasted from 72 through 79. And then in 1980, he married Jean Kasem. And their marriage was good, but his kids did not like her at all.
And of course, this isn't unusual.
Yeah. And I mean, I looked through a couple of different sources and I didn't really find a bunch of reasoning besides, you know, the typical stepmom stuff. I just think they weren't fans of her, but they loved their dad. They were all about their dad, just not her.
Yeah. And I'm glad to hear that, you know, Casey did. He was able to maintain a positive relationship with his kids. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, both dad and stepmom, or mother and stepdad, sometimes they both become alienated from the kids because the kids hold a grudge against both.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, this marriage that took place in 72, let's see, he would have been 40.
Yes.
He was born in 32. So we have to say that he didn't rush into marriage.
No.
It's interesting that he didn't have a child and wasn't married until later on. And so he's 40 years old, his first marriage. He's married for 6-7 years.
Yeah.
And then this woman he meets, Jean, whatever.
I couldn't find her last name, but she's just known as Jean Kasem.
So she was she was actually in Cheers.
Yes. She played
the wife of
she was like the tall, dumb, blonde wife of Carla, or she was married to Carla's ex-husband.
That character.
Yes.
So
I did not remember the name of.
And I've
that
not. I have to
either.
Confess, I didn't watch much of Cheers. But anyway, she wasn't what you'd call a successful actress in a financial sense. That's the only credit that I found. I'm sure she did some acting other than that
mm-hmm.
show, but that's all I saw listed was that she had been in Cheers, and she had had that role for a period of time, several years at
mm-hmm.
least. So they marry and apparently have, in fairness, we have to say it appears to have been a happy
marriage. Yeah, a decent marriage. I mean, they looked like they were in love. They didn't have anything going on. But we also, I mean, their marriage ran up into his diagnosis and everything like that. So,
and through his death, just to make clear, whenever he married Jean in 80, that marriage lasted until his death. But during this period, his children, of course, had become adults,
mm-hmm.
and these three children. He had one child by Jean, who I see nothing about.
Mm-mm.
Liberty was her name.
Yes.
There's
absolutely nothing about her. I have not found anything.
Yeah. When we put together these shows, Marley, you know, does research. It's not to say that there's not something out there. There might be, but you know, you go to a number of sources
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting that you would see all this discussion about the three kids from the first marriage, which granted there was litigation, but you thought that involved in that, at least on the periphery, would have been Liberty.
Yeah.
Who was the child of the second marriage, the only child.
You would think she would be backing up her mom or something.
I didn't see any mention of her. And I looked too at these court, these court documents, which did not say either that she testified
mm-hmm.
or. So we don't know. There's lots of things that maybe some of you all will know some of these details that we don't. And if you do, it'd be interesting to have you post them. You can put them in our comments section. So he's diagnosed with this disease. Now, keep in mind, he's having a successful career, as we just described. You know, there has to be a substantial amount of money coming in throughout this period of time. His copyrights from reruns in the 70s. Incidentally, that's still going on.
Yeah.
So we'll talk more about assets in a minute. But he apparently life was pretty good financially mm-hmm. for them. There shouldn't have been any struggles. We can go ahead and mention that in 1980, was it that he bought her as a birthday present, this huge mansion?
Yeah, the L.A. mansion that is still known today, and they held on to it through his death until she eventually sold it.
Yeah, and but after it was listed in 21.
21, yeah, for $38
million. Yeah, so $38 million, even in L.A. area, that's a mansion. He did well financially. Life's good. It's going along. No signs of problem in his marriage, as mm-hmm. we suggested a while ago. We didn't see any. There's nothing on record of problems in their marriage. This becomes a little bit of an issue because of accusations the children will make in a second. So then you're about to explain his diagnosis. Talk about that.
Yeah. So in 2013, Carrie Kasem comes forward and talks about how Casey Kasem was apparently diagnosed in 2007 with Parkinson's disease, but that story eventually evolves, and we find out that it wasn't actually Parkinson's disease. It's Lewy body disease, which is really, really similar to Parkinson's, and it's a lot of the time it's hard to diagnose because people think that it's the same thing. But it's basically a form of dementia that will take on the same effects as Parkinson's, but a little bit worse, with, you know, the dementia on top and so on and so forth.
So this Lewy body disorder is or disease is something that is perhaps affects more prominently the brain mm-hmm. and as we understand. So there is deterioration. It resembles Parkinson's mm-hmm. as you said, but there's deterioration. Now what's very interesting is this diagnosis that occurred in 2007, we know that Casey Kasem continued working on a number of projects, including several of the hits, the continuing mm-hmm. hits franchise until 2009. Mm-hmm. So he was functional until that point. And then apparently he deteriorated further, and he signed a document in 2007. Let's talk about that.
Yeah, so he signed a power of attorney document in 2007 that actually named Julie as his power of attorney. And this will kind of turn around to where we see Carrie come out as the power of attorney. But he signed that, and it was basically saying, you know, if anything happens to me, then Julie takes over everything. If I need a conservatorship, then Julie is in charge of that. And where this document goes and what happens with it, we'll kind of see that it's just kind of thrown out the window when it boils down to it.
And it seems like that as a practical standpoint.
Yeah.
So what this document is a durable power of attorney for healthcare. When you read about incidents like this, you can easily start thinking that these documents aren't helpful because, as you'll see in a few moments, you can still have a mess. But keep in mind that these documents, like a durable power of attorney for healthcare, and there's a durable power of attorney, period, which is for all the other stuff, like your legal stuff, your business matters. They can move money around your bank account, deal with insurance. They can just do all the things you would do, with the exception of changing your basic mm-hmm. estate plan. They can't do that, which most people don't want done. But that's a durable power of attorney in its general sense. Call it a general power of attorney. The other is a durable power of attorney for healthcare. And in California, as in virtually every state, there is a form of the durable power of attorney for healthcare. As a matter of fact, it's a uniform act that is almost identical from state to state, except for a couple of respects. But there are a couple other things which are important, too. There's also, don't confuse this with something like a DNR, do not resuscitate. It's another thing that a family member who has authority is allowed to communicate to medical personnel, but the DNR is only applicable to the medical personnel in a particular facility. And then the other thing is that you can have a living will, and a living will is not to be confused with a will. A living will just deals with healthcare issues, and it's where you can express to the world, not just empowering a particular person, mm-hmm. like a durable power of attorney for healthcare. A living will is a declaration to the world, would apply to everybody, anybody in whose care you are. You are saying, I want, for example, to have artificial nutrition and hydration discontinued under these circumstances. And you may say where there's no cognitive activity or something such as that. You define, you may say, I never want that discontinued, and some people don't. They may say you can discontinue other artificial life-sustaining technology, but not food and nutrition, food and water, which is, you know, hydration and nutrition. So different people obviously want different things, and this living will is a wonderful way for you to declare to the world, this is what I want, and it's this document would be handed to healthcare officials. It could be handed to anyone. So it's not saying this is the person who makes decisions for me. It's just saying this is what I want, and incidentally, that is conclusive. However, you don't want that document to be contrary to a durable power of attorney, mm-hmm. in which you want somebody to do something different, because then you have a situation that invites litigation. And I suspect at a war between the two, authority is going to be found in the living will. By the way, I was just talking with Justin, our sound guy, and what are you, Justin? This very important person on the other side of this glass has suggested that because we have 75 minutes here, that we may want to break it into two parts, that many of you, rather than do it in one setting, may want to do it in two. So we're going to make it easy for you. We'll do that. So you'll find parts one and two on the subject of Casey Kasem. Till next time, take care.
You've been listening to Life's Third Act, a podcast for thriving in retirement. Sponsored by Tucker Allen, your estate and elder law advisors. Each week, we discuss topics and answer questions to help you better plan for your future. For more information, visit TuckerAllen.com. Subscribe and listen again next week for another edition of Life's Third Act. The choice of a lawyer is an important decision and should not be based solely on advertisements.